Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 2 Samuel chapter 11. We're going to consider the story of David and Bathsheba. Our context is this. In the last chapter, chapter 10, David has whipped up on the Ammonites, that pagan country, which is, of course, the Jordan River to the east, and even further east than the eastern Israelite tribe of Gad, with its capital at Rabbath Ammon. And the Ammonites had got a lot of Syrian allies all the way up from south of Lake Hula, Beth Rehob, Makkah, then east of the Anti-Lebanon Range up there in the Syrian desert. That would be Zobah. And then going further south there, south of Geshur, south of the Golan Heights, on the eastern side of the Jordan River, we have the land of Tob. At least we think that's where it is. The scholars do. And all these Syrians got together with Ammonites, and they had a big battle, and David ended up beating Ammon outside of Rabbah, and then moving back up north in the Syrian desert, somewhere between Hamath on the Orontes and the Euphrates River up there in the Syrian desert at a place called Helam, and David had whipped up on the Syrians. This all happened in the last chapter. So he's sitting pretty. He's won, Adam Clark says, about 8 battles in a row he's won. He's a big shot. He's got it made, until he looks through a window and sees a naked woman. We start with now with 2 Samuel 11, verse 1. Then it happened in the spring, at the time when kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel. And they destroyed the sons of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. But David stayed at Jerusalem. Now, this happened in the springtime, in the season before, probably late in the last spring, or maybe in the fall, or maybe in the wintertime. I don't know, probably not the wintertime, but the previous year, let's put it that way, David had beaten the Ammonites, as I just described to you in the previous chapter. And Joab, after winning that battle, the army of Ammon went back into their city at Rabbah, their capital city, and Joab went north to beat the Syrians, as I just said, describing the last chapter. And so Joab had left the battle in front of Rabbah and gone back to Jerusalem. The speculation is, why didn't he just go ahead and attack the city at that time? Because the weather wasn't right. But the weather's right now, and so Joab heads back to Ammon, and this time they besiege it and destroy the sons of Ammon while they besieged Rabbah. Why was the spring the best time to go out to battle? Well, the rain is over. The rainy season is over. It's easier to move troops. There's plenty of food available. The grass is in the fields for the horses. The fruit is on the trees for the soldiers. The grain is ripe. That's good for the horses as well as the soldiers. It's not too hot. It's not too cold. The grain harvest is over in April or May. The NIV Study Bible says that's the barley harvest. And then the citizen soldiers don't have to plow their fields anymore. They can go out and fight. They would have to come back in the fall for the fall harvest in September to October, and I would imagine they have to come back for the early summer harvest, the wheat harvest, too. But at any rate, they had to fight between harvest, and so the harvest is over. It's springtime. Love is in the air, so let's go attack Ammon, the Ammonites. Now, this Rabbah, this city, is about 40 miles east of Jerusalem. You get to Jerusalem, you go east, cross the Jordan River. You're in the Transjordan, eastern side of the Jordan River, Israelite tribe of Gad. You keep going till you go through Gad's eastern border, and you're in Ammon, and you go and you end up going 40 miles from Jerusalem. You end up at Ammon, at Rabbah, excuse me, the capital of Ammon. Now, Rabbah is still there today. It's the present day capital called Ammon. Rabbah is sometimes called Rabbath Ammon in the scriptures, and today it's called Ammon. It's the same city, still there. Got an airport. Now, Joab is going to fight Rabbah, but David stayed at Jerusalem. And why is that mentioned? Well, because he's up to no good in Jerusalem, and that's why it's mentioned. It sets up the story that follows of David and Bathsheba. Now, why did David stay instead of going with Joab to fight? Well, because top leaders are usually kept at the rear of armies so they don't get killed, at least most of the time. That reminds me of General Robert E. Lee at Spotsylvania. General Lee was leading the troops on his horse in the olden days of warfare before machine guns took over. And the troops said, uh-oh, General Lee's going to get killed. So they grabbed his horse and they started saying, Lee to the rear, Lee to the rear, Lee to the rear. And of course, a good general doesn't want to be in the rear because it doesn't make you look very heroic. But Lee did. He went back to the rear and he survived the battle. At any rate, David didn't need to go to the battle. He could control the battle. He was only 40 miles away. In fact, twice he sent messages to his commander Joab, 2 Samuel 11:6, this chapter. Joab sent to Joab saying, send me Uriah the Hittite. That's one message. And then 2 Samuel 11:14, now in the morning David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. So twice he communicated 40 miles, I guess. I don't know how long it would take to go 40 miles, a couple days maybe, but it's doable. So we go now to 2 Samuel 11:2-3. Now when evening came, David arose from his bed and walked around on the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful in appearance. So David sent and inquired about the woman. And one said, "Is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? Now a man sees a naked woman." Well, it reminds me of a joke I heard about how can you blame Adam for the fall of man? Eve's walking around naked and says, eats this fruit. What would you do? This is going to be a sad story here. Now, what's he on the roof for? Well, he's walking around at dusk, the evening, towards sun. It couldn't be completely dark yet. David wouldn't be able to see, as John Gill says, but he's walking around up there. It's cooler at night, and so that's probably why he's there. And, of course, the roofs are flat back there, and a lot of stuff is done on the roof, a lot of socializing, a lot of talking. So he sees a woman bathing. He's probably up higher. This is a palace, his palace, and he's looking down. He probably has an angle on the window, and he sees her bathing. Now, it says in verse 2 that David arose from his bed. You might ask, what's a bed doing on the roof, and what's he doing there? Well, he's probably taking a nap in the middle of the day. It's too hot to do business. It cools off. The breeze starts blowing. He wakes up, getting ready to do some work, and looks through the window, and there she is, naked. Now, here's some speculations as to why Bathsheba would take a bath where she could be seen. Here's option number one. This is Adam Clark's view. Bathsheba was deliberately trying to be provocative. She's a married woman now. And this is what Clark says, quote, "How could any woman of delicacy expose herself where she could be so fully and openly viewed? Did she not know that she was at least in view of the king's terrace? Was there no design in all this?" Well, Adam Clark is awful suspicious of Bathsheba. It could be that she was not trying to be provocative. She just didn't count on someone being on the palace roof looking in her apartment, a peeping Tom, the king of Israel being a peeping Tom. And it could be that David could look down easy because he's up in the air, but she can't look up easily because she's down below. She might not have realized that somebody had a clear shot. Now, Bathsheba in verse 2 is said to be beautiful in appearance. Now, this illustrates the truth of that 1960s pop song, "If you want to be happy for the rest of your life, make an ugly woman your wife." Now, Bathsheba's husband, Uriah the Hittite, did not follow that advice. He has a beautiful wife, and beautiful women are tempting to other men besides the husband. Now, here's an application point here, using David as the object lesson. Men really need to push feminine beauty down on their wish list, at least to number 2. Oh, I want to marry a woman because she's beautiful. That's just absolutely stupid. I remember a fellow professor of mine at one of my colleges in China that I was teaching at, and he was going through all the horrors that he was having in courts with his ex-wife, who was setting him up and cheating him and robbing him. And I finally said, "Why in the world did you ever marry this woman? She sounds awful." And he immediately said, "Because she was beautiful." Oh, not a good idea to marry a beautiful woman. A lot of beautiful women are ugly on the inside. Well, I don't know how ugly Bathsheba was, how provocative she was. We're going to talk a little bit about her character as we go through this. She seems to not be a little innocent babe, to be quite honest with you. She got herself involved in royal politics after she ends up marrying David. So I don't know how innocent she was, but I will give her the benefit of the doubt. She didn't mean to be looking. And besides, it's always the man's fault. Even if she had been provocative, David didn't have to look. He didn't have to call her out, inquire after her and ask her to come up to the palace. He didn't have to do that. Now, you know, when David got the message after he inquired about the woman, you know, he may have had the intention of marrying her if she'd been single. Oh, yeah, see a naked woman, I want to marry you. That's dumb. But, of course, he's a king and kings do that sort of thing, maybe. But when he got message back that the woman was a wife, that should have told him, hey, that's the end of story. That should have stopped David cold, but it didn't. We go down to 2 Samuel 11:4-5. David sent messengers and took her, and when she came to him, he lay with her. And when she had purified herself from her uncleanness, she returned to her house. The woman conceived, and she sent and told David and said, I am pregnant. Now, verse 4 says that David took her. Now, what does that mean, took her? Well, there's a couple of options. It could mean he took her by persuasion, as John Gill believes. Or, option number 2, he took her by force. Well, let's take that option. Did he take her by force? Well, it was common for kings of that day to take any woman they wanted for their harem, whether they were married or not. The NIV Study Bible says this was against Israelite law, and I couldn't find the site of the law where it said that was illegal, but it wouldn't surprise me. And so I find it hard to believe that David's a rapist, a royal rapist. Now, it's true that David's high status might make the average woman tend to want to submit to him because he was king. But still, if David were not a rapist and Bathsheba had said, "No, David, I'm a married woman, I'm not going to do this," David, in my opinion, would not have raped her. He would have said, "Okay, talk to you later." So we're going to assume that she was persuaded to commit adultery, so that means she was partially guilty of this as well as David was. Now, if she was forced, as John Gill says, she would have probably protested. That's an argument from silence. The text doesn't say whether she was forced or not. But if she was forced, it probably would have showed up in the text, I would think. So I don't think this was a rape. John Gill says she was rather drawn by the greatness and goodness of David. Maybe that's why. He was a king. Oh, I get to have sex with a king. I don't care if I'm married or not. Maybe so. Or maybe she's thinking, maybe I can be queen. And maybe I can get pregnant by him and have a son that's going to be a king. That's Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown's idea. I think that's stretching a little bit, but this is their basis for this. They turn ahead to 1 Kings chapter 1, verses 13, 14, 16, and 17, which we'll read now. Bathsheba tells someone, "Go at once to King David and say to him, 'Have you not, my lord, O king, sworn to your maidservant,'" sworn to me, Bathsheba, "'saying, surely Solomon your son shall be king after me?" And dropping down to verse 17, she said to him, "My lord, you swore to your maidservant by the Lord your God, saying, 'Surely your son Solomon shall be king after me.'" Well, that passage doesn't say when Bathsheba made the deal with David and David swore to her that Solomon would be king. That's probably after Bathsheba had married him, had had Solomon, and there was a bunch of other royal offspring running around. And she says, "I want you to put Solomon on the throne ahead of all the other ones, like Adonijah." So that doesn't mean that she plotted that while she was committing adultery with David. That was probably an afterthought. However, this does show that Bathsheba was no innocent babe in the woods. As Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, quote, "She appears to have been a woman of superior talents and address in obtaining the object of her ambition, in her securing that her son should succeed on the throne, in her promptitude to give notice of her pregnancy, in her activity in defeating Adonijah's natural expectation of succeeding to the crown, in her dignity as the king's mother." Now, we'll see all that later as the story unfolds in future chapters. But this is interesting. The fact that she immediately told David, which we'll see in this chapter, that she was pregnant, that shows that she's planning to put him on the throne? Maybe so. I still think that's a little bit of a stretch, though. I mean, I can imagine, even if she had no plans to put her baby, she doesn't even know whether it's a boy, for one thing. It could have been a girl, but I don't think she has plans right now to put this potential boy on the throne. I think it's only natural to say, "Hey, you got me pregnant." Now, in verse 4, there's an interesting little detail that's going to lead to a whole lot of speculation, all of which we'll go through. Verse 4 says, "When she had purified herself from her uncleanness, she returned to her house." Now, that's the New American Standard Bible translation. Now, let's take that translation first. What does it sound like? He lay with her, that's mentioned first, so that she has sex with him, and then she purifies herself from her uncleanness, so she goes, takes a bath, washes herself, and then she returns to her house. That's what it sounds like. But I don't think that's what happened. Let's look at the NIV translation. "She came to him and he slept with her." Parentheses, "She had purified herself from her uncleanness." In other words, she had taken a bath earlier to purify herself from her menstrual impurity, which happened before she came to David's apartment. 2 Samuel 11:4, the Holman Christian Study Bible. "David sent messengers to get her, and when she came to him, he slept with her. Now, she had just been purifying herself from her uncleanness." In other words, before she showed up at David's roof apartment, she was bathing to clean herself from her uncleanness, after which she returned home. Now, assuming the Holman Christian Study Bible and the NIV are right, and I think they are, we can see now probably why she was taking the bath that David saw her taking. Once a woman menstruates, she is prescribed by law. She is ordered by law to purify herself. Leviticus 15:19-23. "When a woman has a discharge, she shall continue in her menstrual impurity for 7 days. Whoever touches her shall be unclean until evening. Everything also on which she lies during her menstrual impurity shall be unclean. Everything on which she sits shall be unclean. Verse 21, Leviticus 15. Anyone who touches her bed shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. And so that's probably why this is mentioned here. She was taking a bath. It was getting on toward evening. She was unclean until evening. She'd taken the bath, so she was Levitically clean, and so she's ready to go commit adultery, which is kind of ironic. But at least Levitically, she was clean. Now, I say she was clean before she went in to have sex with David. How long before she went in to have sex with David is not stated, but I assume it was a week to 10 days later, because that's the most fertile time for a woman, 7 to 10 days after she has her period, and she did get pregnant when she went into David. So I'm speculating that it was not just at that very moment that she went over to see David. Verse 23, whether it be on the bed or on the thing on which she is sitting, when he touches it, he shall be unclean until evening. And so David would know when he's committing adultery with her. At least they're not breaking the Levitical law in that aspect, at least, although they're committing adultery. Now, why was this seemingly insignificant detail mentioned, that she had purified herself from her uncleanness? That doesn't mean she purified herself from committing adultery. You can't purify yourself from committing adultery. It means from her menstrual impurity. Well, here's some possible reasons. Here's option number one. She wanted, or the text mentions, that she had cleansed herself to show that David would be more ready to take her. Having sex with a purified woman means you're not having sex with a menstruating woman, because if you do that, you're unclean also. So David may have preferred not to have sex with a woman who was legally unclean. He also might have preferred not to have sex with a woman who was menstruating merely for aesthetic reasons. A lot of people don't like to do that. And as a matter of fact, when I say if it were for legal reasons he didn't want to have sex with her, the law says in Leviticus 18:19, you are not to come near a woman during her menstrual impurity to have sexual intercourse with her. But if this is true, if this is the reason that David didn't want to have sex with her, or the reason that the cleansing bath was mentioned to show that it would help David get over his scruples about having sex with a ritually unclean woman, we might have to point out that that's awful strange for David to quibble over that. After all, he's committing adultery. You would think if he's going to commit adultery and break the law, why not just go ahead and break the law over having sex with an unclean woman? But it also might be for aesthetic reasons. David might not have wanted to have sex with a woman that's menstruating. Well, that might be one reason why the fact that she purified herself from her uncleanness was mentioned in the text. That might be one reason. Here's another reason. It might have just been a reason for the storyteller, the author of 2 Samuel, to show why Bathsheba was taking the bath that caused David to lust. It might just be an incidental detail. She was purifying herself. That's why she was taking a bath and David looked at her, which would mean the detail would not have any important consequences at all. But here's the real reason, in my humble opinion, why the detail is mentioned. It was to show that Bathsheba was not pregnant by Uriah when David slept with her. If she's purifying herself, that means she has just menstruated, and if she's menstruating after Uriah left, Uriah can't be a father of her child, which means that the child who was later born to Bathsheba was not Uriah's child. And so that little detail tells us that there's no question it's David's, not Uriah's. I think that's the real reason it was mentioned. Now, this brings up another question, which is complicated. Was Uriah away long enough to know, should he return, that a baby would not be his? Well, let's say that if Bathsheba was on her period when Uriah left. Now, if that were so, and Uriah left and came back, her pregnancy would prove that she was an adulteress. It would prove to Uriah that his wife was an adulteress for two reasons. One, Uriah wouldn't be having sex with his menstruating wife. That's against the law. So if he's not having sex with her, well, who got her pregnant? Not me, not Uriah. The second reason why if Bathsheba was on a period when Uriah left is a menstruating woman can't be pregnant. That's the whole purpose of menstruation, is to prepare the womb for pregnancy, and the womb ain't prepared yet, so she can't be pregnant. So for those two reasons, that would prove that Bathsheba's subsequent child would not be Uriah's. Now let's speculate that if Uriah had sex with her before her period, so he doesn't know that she's menstruating, he has sex with her, that means he could have gotten her pregnant. Now, let's say he returns 1 month later from the war, and he watches Bathsheba get larger and larger and larger until 9 or 10 months later, depending on, well, let's say 9 months later, there's no problem because it would be his baby. He had sex with her. He didn't know she was infertile because there was no menstruation. He had sex with her because there was no menstruation. And he could have had that baby. Of course, it would be David's baby, as it turns out, but he wouldn't know that. Well, let's say Uriah has sex with her before a period. He goes off to war and comes back a year later. Well, the baby would be born about 9 months after Uriah's sex with Bathsheba. David's sperm having been substituted for Uriah's, a baby would be born, but Uriah would have no reason to be suspicious because he would think, I had sex with her, so I got her pregnant. So in my humble opinion, I think Uriah knew of Bathsheba's period before he left. And for that reason, he hadn't had sex with her, and that's why he would be surprised when he got back and found her pregnant, and that's why David tried to get Uriah in her bed. Now, I realize this is a lot of speculation here, but it makes sense to me. And the fact that David went to so much trouble to get Uriah back in Bathsheba's bed to cover up his deed makes me think that that must have been the case, that she was menstruating when Uriah left, because all David had to do was say, okay, Bathsheba, I got you pregnant, but it doesn't matter. Did you have sex with Uriah before he left? Oh, of course, I had sex with him. He was going off to war. It might have been my last time. Well, you had sex with him. That's how you got pregnant. And that's the end of the story. But it didn't turn out like that. So I think that's why this detail was mentioned. She had purified herself from uncleanness. She was menstruating. Now, in all those previous speculations, I was assuming that Uriah had just gone off to the war and David had just had sex with Bathsheba at approximately the same time. In that case, if Uriah came back and he saw a baby, he could think it was his baby if he hadn't known she was menstruating, and if he had known she was menstruating, then he would be suspicious. But now there's another situation where the menstruation would not make any difference. Let's say he had sex with Bathsheba 5 months ago before David did, and then he goes off to the war 5 months before David has sex with Bathsheba, and he gets back and Bathsheba says, honey, I'm pregnant and the baby's going to be born 9 months from now, and that would mean a 14-month gestation period for Uriah's baby, and he's going to immediately know there's something wrong here. So that could have been the case too, but I'm assuming here that all of this happened right about the same time. Uriah goes to war, and shortly thereafter, David ends up having sex with Bathsheba. Then the menstruation does become important. She returns to her house after having sex with David. Now let's look one more time at the NAB and New American Standard Bible's time sequence, which I don't agree with. She comes to David, she has sex with David, and then she purifies herself and then she goes home. So somehow she has sex with David, then takes a bath in David's apartment, purifying herself. Well, that would mean she is purifying herself after having menstruated, which would mean she would be having sex with David while she's menstruating, which is illegal. Now, you could say the answer to that, well, yeah, well, she's an adulteress too. She's not going to scruple over breaking the menstruation laws. Well, but if she had sex with David and then took a bath to purify herself, as the NASB says, that would mean that David would be having sex with Bathsheba during her menstruation or shortly thereafter, and that is a very unlikely time in a woman's menstrual cycle to get pregnant. But she did get pregnant. So it's likely that Bathsheba had finished menstruating long enough to get pregnant. Most people say it's about 7 days, a week or so later, before the womb is prepared, before the egg gets deposited there in the womb to get impregnated. Well, she got pregnant. So I assume that she was at home. She menstruated. She purified herself. About a week or 10 days goes by when she's at her most fertile time in the cycle. She goes into David and gets herself pregnant. Now, the reason I know about when it's likely or not likely to get pregnant is because my wife and I used to use something called natural family planning, and you have to be aware of those things so that you can have kids or not have kids depending on when in the woman's, in the wife's cycle that you have relations. I had a friend of mine who misread the instructions of the method. He's trying not to have babies, and he has relations with his wife at the most fertile time of her cycle, and boy, did he have babies. And he blamed the method, of course. It wasn't the method's fault. It was his fault because he didn't use the instructions right. But anyway, I know these time periods are exactly right. I know it very well, so I think that's what happened. So let me repeat all that. Uriah's getting ready to go off to war. Bathsheba menstruates. So Uriah says, well, I can't have sex with you. I'll have sex with you when I get back. He leaves. Bathsheba bathes and purifies herself. Now, I don't think the bathing and purifying herself was the time that David looked through the window and saw her. I think she probably did it a week or so before David looked, because it takes that long to get fertile, and she got pregnant. So anyway, she takes a bath. Week go by. She takes another bath in front of the window. David sees her, and the rest is history. Now, the fact that Bathsheba was pregnant put David in real deep doo-doo, because now his sin would be found out. Now, you know, the legal penalty for adultery was death to both the parties, Leviticus 20:10. If there is a man who commits adultery with another man's wife, one who commits adultery with his friend's wife, the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death. I like that, his friend's wife. I guess that's how it normally happens, because you're friends with the wife, you're friends with the wife's husband, and that makes it even worse. But anyway, they're both subject to death. Now think of the political crisis that would have caused. You're going to put the king to death? What David did was absolute folly, the stupidest of stupidest things that he ever could do. He would also be known to have cuckolded a brave man, Uriah. He's out there risking, he's risking his life fighting for king and country. He leaves his wife at home, and the king shacks up with her. That reminds me of a story I read about Thomas Jefferson, who was at home on Monticello, his plantation, and his neighbor, who also owned a plantation, went off to fight in the Revolutionary War. And while he was, and before he left, he goes over to Thomas Jefferson. He says, "Tom, please look in after my wife and take care of her. I'm going to leave her alone on the plantation." Well, Thomas Jefferson, he looked in on her all right. He took care of her all right. And from the history I read, again, a lot of this is scuttlebutt, you know, because there's a lot of politics involved, but it convinced me that he was not honorable toward his neighbor's wife. Thomas Jefferson was not. But at any rate, that's the sort of thing that happens here. Now, one other question. Why didn't David just pretend that Uriah was the father? He said, "Okay, yeah, you're pregnant, Bathsheba. Your husband did it." Well, because Uriah's going to come back from the battle. Let's say he's gone 3 or 4 months. The baby's 3 or 4 months pregnant already. The baby gets born after about, say, 4 months after Uriah gets back, and people are going to say, "Boy, that was a fast pregnancy, Bathsheba. Your husband got you pregnant when he came back from the war, and bam, there's the baby." Well, as I said earlier, Uriah could have gotten around that by saying, "Well, I had sex with her before I left, and that's why she's pregnant. That's why she had a baby." But I suspect that David knew that she was menstruating and was not pregnant, and David knew that Uriah knew that she was not menstruating, and so David would realize that, oops, somebody's got my wife pregnant. And just talking around, it wouldn't take long before he would figure out it was David. He could have asked Bathsheba, for one thing. Also, David has sent messengers to Bathsheba's place and said, "Send Bathsheba to me." Well, is that not going to get out? Oh, yeah, it'll get out. Well, you know, you would think that David, king that he was, would realize that he's going to be put in a bad spot if Uriah doesn't realize that, if Uriah realizes that Uriah could not have been the father. He's going to be in a bad way. Well, a man in the midst of lust usually switches his brain off, and David did that. We go down to 2 Samuel 11, verses 6 through 9. Then David sent to Joab. Now remember, Joab is his military commander. He doesn't like Joab. Joab has killed Abner, Saul's, the northern kingdom of Benjamin's general, as we've already gone through that story. David had to go into great lamentations for Abner because he was trying to politically unite the north and the southern kingdoms with the northern tribes with the southern tribe of Judah. He's trying to do that, and Joab screwed him up, and Joab killed Abner because Abner had killed Joab's younger brother Asahel. So David sent to Joab saying, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." Now, of course, Joab is outside the walls of Rabbath Ammon, besieging the city, and Uriah is one of the military officers with Joab. So Joab, having received the message, Joab sent Uriah to David. Verse 7, when Uriah came to him, David asked concerning the welfare of Joab and the people and the state of the war. Then David said to Uriah, "Go down to your house and wash your feet." And Uriah went out of the king's house, and a present from the king was sent out after him. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord and did not go down to his house. Now, of course, in verse 6, the reason that David told Joab, "Send me Uriah the Hittite," he's trying to get Uriah back so he can have sex with Bathsheba to cover up that illegitimate pregnancy. He probably at that time had no intentions to kill Uriah and to marry Bathsheba. He was just trying to cover it up. But you know, cover-ups, it's a crime, and cover-up crimes often lead to worse crimes. And in this case, it did. Now, Uriah is called the Hittite. One might ask, what was a Hittite doing in the Israelite army? Well, David had many foreign mercenaries fighting for him from the very beginning when he was running from Saul. We read in 1 Samuel 22:2, everyone who was in distress and everyone who was in debt and everyone who was discontented gathered to him. So there was a lot of people outside, marginalized people of society, let's put it that way, who were fighting with David. Now the Hittites, that was a famous kingdom in present-day Turkey, the landmass of Anatolia from about, what, 1600 B.C. to 1200 B.C. It's a huge kingdom. It was an empire. But it had kind of petered out by now because it's now about 1000 B.C. But there were still people who were Hittites from that kingdom who had moved around, wandered around. And a lot of them had settled down near Hebron, actually, in Israel. So he wasn't from present-day Turkey. He wasn't from way up there. He was just of the ethnic group of the Hittites who had been moving around. Now, even though he was a Hittite, his name Uriah indicates pretty apparently that Uriah had converted to Yahweh. Uriah means, my light is the Lord. My light is the Yahweh, which is kind of sad. If, of course, you can't go by names. A lot of times people don't live up to their names, but he's not a pagan anymore. So when Uriah shows up in Jerusalem and David asks Uriah, how's Joab doing? How natural can we think that David was in carrying out this scheme? John Gill says he wasn't natural at all. Gill says that David seems to have been at a loss what to say to him, that David is asking very mean and trivial questions. How's Joab? I don't think that's true. I think Gill is completely off the wall here. Gill says that these questions that David were asked, that David was asking Uriah being mean and trivial, might justly give Uriah some suspicion. Uriah might be sitting there and thinking, what's the king asking me all these dumb questions for? Since David could not really want intelligence of such mundane matters. He's getting expresses from the front. Messengers are coming from the battle all the time. What does he need me to tell him about what's going on? Well, I think Gill is wrong thinking that way. It's only natural for a king to get all the information he can about a battle. You got one of your chief military officers. Yeah, ask him how it's going. So that's, I don't think, I think he's perfectly natural. He's keeping up a brave front. He's not going to let Uriah know that he's done anything suspicious. Verse 8, David said to Uriah, go down to your house and wash your feet. Well, that seems like a strange thing to do. Well, that's because it's a cultural thing. Wash your feet means prepare yourself to go to bed. And that's what they did back then. They walked around in dust all the time, so you wash your feet before you get into bed. Reminds me of living in China. My feet were black all the time. I always kept my feet over the end of the bed so they wouldn't touch a sheet. Well, David is saying to Uriah, go home, rest, go to bed, which is exactly what David wanted to do, because in that bed, in said bed, there would be a wife named Bathsheba, and one thing might lead to another, and then, whew, we can blame that pregnancy on Uriah and not me, David. Basically, what he's saying, you're tired from battle, Uriah. Go home and relax. Uriah didn't accommodate David. In verse 9, Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants. The servants' quarters there must have been there near the front gate of David's palace. Why did Uriah refuse to go home? This is interesting to speculate. Could have been he was just too sleepy to go home. He had gotten back from the front. He was weary from fighting and then traveling those 40 miles. He may have been detained by the bodyguard at the door. The soldiers there might have said, how's the war going? How's the war going? And they might have kept him from going back home. He might have been tired. He might have been detained. But it could be that Uriah actually was suspicious of something, suspicious of David. Now, John Gill and Jameson Foster Brown suggest this. Uriah could have become suspicious of David because of the strange action of David's, calling Uriah back from the front for no apparent reason. Well, I don't know about that. There could have been an apparent reason. It could have been that Uriah was dispatched from the front to give David news, just like many other dispatches David got from the front. So perhaps that might not have made Uriah suspicious of what's going on, but something else might have. The guards might have told Uriah that David had called for Bathsheba. Because everybody's going to know that. He just sent a messenger and everybody's going to know that. People are going to see Bathsheba walking into the king's apartment. I mean, whew. David lived in a fishbowl. He was in a royal palace. And so the guards might have said, yeah, you know, King David asked Bathsheba to come see him up there. And Uriah might then have put two and two together. So Uriah might have been suspicious and he said, no, if my wife's pregnant because of what David did, I'm not going to cover up for him. Another thing that might have aroused suspicion is that David had given Uriah a present. He sent him away and then sent a present after him. That might have made Uriah suspicious. What is he treating me like this for? He's got me in here talking to me, then he's sending me a present? Jameson Fawcett Brown says, quote, this present was, quote, a portion of meat from the royal table sent to one's house or lodgings, is one of the greatest compliments which an Eastern prince can pay. Why is he complimenting me? Well, so yeah, maybe Uriah was suspicious of David. But we could also speculate maybe he's not suspicious of David at all, and he just has a high sense of military duty. He wants to be with his fellow soldiers. They're out there fighting and risking their life, and he's back home getting on with his wife. That doesn't look good for a soldier. It might have been embarrassing for Uriah to stay at home while his military buddies were on duty. Now, if we read on here, we'll see that that option is actually a pretty good option from what he says later in verses 10 through 13, 2 Samuel 11. Now, when they told David, that's the servants of David at the gatehouse of the palace. Now, when they told David, saying, Uriah did not go down to his house, David said to Uriah, have you not come from a journey? Apparently, David went back down to where he was sleeping and said, hey, haven't you come from a journey and you're down here sleeping with the servants? What's going on here? Why did you not go down to your house? Verse 11, Uriah said to David, the ark and Israel and Judah are staying in temporary shelters, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife? By your life and the life of your soul, I will not do this thing. Well, there's the ostensible reason why Uriah didn't go back home, was because it would not be good for a soldier to do that. It would not be the military thing to do. Now, either he really meant that, or he knows what David's up to, and he's given David a perfectly legitimate reason to cover his, Uriah's, knowledge of David's crime. Not sure. You have to speculate. But the important thing is, he's not going home. He's not going, whether inadvertently or on purpose, he's not going to cover up David's crime. Verse 12, then David said to Uriah, stay here today also, and tomorrow I will let you go. So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. He still didn't go home. Verse 13, and David called him, and he ate and drank before him. And he, David, made Uriah drunk. And in the evening he went out to lie on his bed with his lord's servants. That's Uriah did that, sleeping with the servants again. But Uriah did not go down to his house. So David's efforts to get Uriah home to have sex with Bathsheba failed. Now in verse 11, Uriah said to David, the ark and Israel and Judah are staying in temporary shelters. Well, Israel and Judah were staying in temporary shelters. He's referring to the soldiers. They're in temporary shelters because they're out there besieging Rabbah over there in Ammon. And so obviously they're in military booths or tents or whatever they used. Tents probably. But also the ark is in a temporary shelter. Uriah says, how is the ark in a temporary shelter? Well, David had built a temporary shelter in Jerusalem, if you recall, when he brought the ark from Kiriath-Jearim into Jerusalem. He didn't bring the tabernacle from Gibeon where it was. He left it there, but he built a temporary shelter for the ark. So that's probably what Uriah is referring to. Some people, and for example, Adam Clark, think that the ark was carried to battle before Rabbah, and so it was in a temporary shelter before the walls of Ammon. Because remember, armies like to take their religious, their god, their idols with them when they fought. And remember, the ark was taken by the sons of Eli, Hophni, and Phinehas to battle the Philistines back at the Battle of Aphek. And so the ark might have been before Rabbah. Now notice, Uriah says something a little bit close to home here after saying, the soldiers are in temporary shelters. Shall I then go to my house to eat and drink and to lie with my wife? Perhaps Uriah mentioned that to really poke a dagger into David. Is that what you want me to do? You want me to go home, eat and drink, and lie with my wife to cover up your crime, he implies? Maybe. Of course, we're having to read between the lines. Now, one last point here, which is a rabbit trail. Verse 11, when Uriah says to David, my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Servants of my lord, that of course is David. But my lord Joab, that's Joab. Now the Jews use this expression as a justification for David killing Uriah. When I say the Jews, I mean the later rabbis. The rabbis say it was treasonous for David to call Joab lord. Now that is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. That is incredibly stupid. Lord is just a polite form of address to a superior. That's all Uriah was referring to, my lord Joab. But this kind of rabbinic logic is, frankly, typical of a lot of rabbinic logic, just plain stupid. Now, here's another justification from the rabbis who are all intent to preserve David's honor. They say that Uriah disobeyed orders to go home and spend the night with Bathsheba. David keeps saying, why don't you go home? Go home and relax. Go home and relax. Well, that's stupid, too. That wasn't a military order. That was just a man trying to be sociable, trying to be kind. There's no order there. Now, it is quite ironic that Uriah deprives himself of his conjugal rights with his wife, and he legally had those rights, but the man who did not have legal rights to the conjugal favors of that woman, he did take advantage of those blessings, if I might put it that way. So the loyal soldier is depriving himself of Bathsheba, but the king is not. And as I said earlier, this may have been conscious irony on Uriah's part to cut David's conscience, as John Gill says. And John Gill also speculates that as David is trying to get Uriah home, assuredly Bathsheba was doing everything in her seductive power also in order to get Uriah home. I wouldn't doubt that. Now Uriah, when David said, "Why don't you go on home?" Uriah says, "By your life and the life of your soul, I will not do this thing. I'm not going to go home and eat and drink and have sex with my wife." By your life and the life of your soul, that's a strong oath. So either he's hamming it up good, or he really means it. I'm not going to desert my fellow soldiers, or he's just putting on a big show in front of David to give him a good reason why he's not going to go home. So David gives up, and in verse 13, he asked David to eat and drink with Uriah to eat and drink with him, and David made Uriah drunk. What was his point there, or his purpose there? David's idea is to get Uriah so drunk he would forget his oath not to go home. By your life, I'm not going home. Well, get drunk. Being drunk, David's sense of military honor would disappear, and he would forget his oath, and he would go home. Didn't work. We go down to 2 Samuel 11, verses 14 through 17. Now in the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. He had written in the letter saying, "Place Uriah in the front line of the fiercest battle and withdraw from him so that he may be struck down and die." So it was, as Joab kept watch on the city, that he put Uriah at the place where he knew there were valiant men. The men of the city went out and fought against Joab, and some of the people among David's servants fell, and Uriah the Hittite also died. Now, Uriah carrying that letter back to the front to give to Joab, the letter that had the instructions to execute Uriah, that was sort of dangerous on David's part. All Uriah had to do was open the letter and he would know of David's murderous treachery. But Uriah was a loyal and trusted soldier. He's not going to open the king's dispatches, and David knew that. Notice how in verse 15, when David says, "Joab, pull your troops back and leave Uriah exposed so that he might die," that was his plan, but look what happened. In verse 17, some of the people among David's servants fell. So David not only murdered Uriah, David also murdered some soldiers. That's like judicial murder. David's using the power of the state to kill people. And judicial murder is always the worst kind. As Matthew Henry points out, the enemies of the Israelites got much aid and comfort from this action of David's. So David is now hurting not just Uriah, but his whole kingdom. Basically, what David was doing was treason. So he is an adulterer, he is a murderer, and he's committed treachery against his own nation. Wow. And I guess the purpose of all this is to show that if God can forgive David, he can forgive anybody. So Joab goes along with this, of course, and arranges the troops such that Uriah is left exposed and he's killed in battle. That's basically Joab does what David told him to do. Now, does that mean that Joab is guilty of being an accomplice to murder? Well, in favor of the argument that yes, he was an accomplice to murder, we look at these factors. First of all, Joab was a murderer. He had already treacherously murdered Abner, as I mentioned several times. So that's something he would do. Matthew Henry speculates maybe Joab had a personal grudge against Uriah, and so he saw a chance to get even with Uriah. Well, maybe, but that's just speculation. But notice that Joab didn't question David's orders to murder Uriah. He was a general who knew how to object to what David wanted in other circumstances, but he didn't object here. For example, in 2 Samuel 19:5, when David was crying over Absalom's death after the Civil War, and all of David's troops were getting upset about it because they had risked their life with David fighting Absalom, and now here David's crying over Absalom, we read this in 2 Samuel 19:5, "Then Joab came into the house to the king and said, 'Today you have covered with shame the faces of all your servants, who today have saved your life and the lives of your sons and daughters, the lives of your wives, and the lives of your concubines.'" So Joab let David hold it then. He didn't have a problem then, but he didn't say anything about murdering Uriah. Now, how about when David tried to do his ill-starred census, 2 Samuel 24:3, "But Joab said to the king, 'Now may the Lord your God add to the people 100 times as many as they are, while the eyes of my lord the king still see. But why does my lord the king delight in this thing?'" In other words, don't do that, David. So Joab knew how to speak truth to power, as the current idiom goes, but he didn't do it. So I'd say that's a pretty strong argument that Joab, yeah, he was an accomplice to murder. Matthew Henry doesn't agree with that. He says that if Joab thought that Uriah committed some capital crime, and this is the way David had chosen to execute Uriah, well, then there would be nothing wrong with what he did. But my answer to that is, Joab didn't know that. If he speculated that, he was a fool. He was an accomplice to murder, folks. I don't care what Matthew Henry says. He's an accomplice to murder. Now, David tells Joab to look for the place where Joab knew that there were valiant men. In other words, at the wall there, find the strongest defense. Put Uriah in a military indefensible position, attacking the strongest defense. Or as he says, place Uriah in the front line of the fiercest battle and withdraw. So Joab, being the general, would know where that was. And so he did it. Verse 17, the men of the city went out and fought against Joab, probably because Joab was sitting in a perfectly militarily indefensible position. And so the valiant men of the Ammonites, they say, well, what is this moron doing out here, this salient, unprotected salient that we can just whoop up on? Why is that? So they left the city, went from a defensive posture to an offensive posture, and fought Joab, killing Uriah the Hittite and some other Hebrew soldiers. So as I said earlier, David didn't only murder Uriah, he murdered some of his own innocent soldiers. And Jameson Fawcett Brown says about this, quote, the various arts and stratagems by which the king tried to cajole Uriah, till at last he resorted to the horrid crime of murder, the cold-blooded cruelty of dispatching the letter by the hands of the gallant but much wronged soldier himself, Uriah, the enlistment of Joab to be a partaker of his sin, the heartless affectation of mourning, that comes later, and the indecent haste of his marriage with Bathsheba have left an indelible stain upon the character of David and exhibit a painfully humiliating proof of the awful lengths to which the best of men may go when they forfeit the restraining grace of God. And I'll be honest with you, I have trouble reading the Psalms when I know what David did here. This was really bad. And of course, he repented later, Psalm 51, and to think that God can forgive some lowlife like David is really amazing. We go now to 2 Samuel chapter 11, verses 18 through 21. Then Joab sent and reported to David all the events of the war. He charged the messenger, saying, when you have finished telling all the events of the war to the king, and if it happens that the king's wrath rises, and he says to you, why did you go so near to the city to fight? Did you not know that they would shoot from the wall? Who struck down Abimelech the son of Jerubbaal? Did not a woman throw an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died at Thebez? Why did you go so near the wall? Then you, says Joab to the messenger, then you, the messenger, shall say, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. Now, there's a lot of speculation as to what Joab is thinking when he sends this message back. It says in verse 20 to the messenger, if it happens that the king's wrath rises, well, that's normally a very logical thing, that a king would be upset because what Joab did was stupid militarily. But this, of course, was not a normal situation. Why would David be angry at all? Why is Joab so worried about the king's wrath rising in front of the messenger? David's orders were carried out with precision, just like David ordered Joab. He did it. Why is he worried about David getting angry? Why did Joab even get into this with the messenger? Why didn't he just go back and say, hey, we had a little battle, Uriah the Hittite's dead, and be done with it? Why did he go into all the stuff about if the king's wrath rises? Well, this is my theory. Joab is trying to let the messenger know that David was guilty. Matthew Henry actually backs me up on that, and he says that Joab gave too broad an intimation to the messenger, and by Joab to others, that David would be secretly pleased to hear that. In other words, if he gets mad because of the military defeat, don't worry, messenger, you just tell him that Uriah's dead and he'll be happy. Well, what does that say? That's basically like saying, messenger, David did it. He was the one that caused the death of Uriah the Hittite. Now, note that, as a matter of fact, the news of the murder did get out. Otherwise, we wouldn't be discussing it now. The news of the murder got out, so it might have started with this messenger who is being hinted at by Joab that his anger will be appeased by knowing that Uriah the Hittite was killed. Therefore, David must be behind it. Now, why would Joab want to implicate David if my theory is accurate? Well, one reason is to cover his shameful military defeat. After all, what Joab did, he went right next to the wall and got himself whipped. It doesn't look good for General Joab, does it? Now, the message was worded to make Joab look good. As Matthew Henry points out, the action was initiated by the besieged Ammonites, not by the Israelites, and the Israelites bravely forced the Ammonites back to the city gate. Yeah, so that looked pretty good, but despite how the message was framed, Joab could still be blamed because they lost. And it was stupid to go so close to the wall. And Joab knew it was stupid, and that's why he kept saying, if the king says, hey, it was stupid to go next to the wall, why did you do it? Just tell him, Uriah the Hittite's dead. So just to make sure that nobody thought this military defeat was Joab's fault, Joab implicated David in the murder of Uriah. Now, Joab never did like David too much, of course. It started with their conflict over Abner when Joab killed Abner, creating almost insurmountable political problems for David because he was trying to win over northern Israel at the time, and Abner was the man who had negotiated the peace with David. And so Joab says, okay, you want me to cover for you and kill Uriah the Hittite? And I wonder why you're doing that, David? What's the reason? Here's a chance to embarrass David. Joab is basically saying, I've got the goods on you, David. Now, Joab goes into a long speculation about how David's anger would rise. David's going to say, why did you go so near to the city wall? Don't you know from the history of the Hebrews about Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal, how he was killed with an upper millstone from the wall? So that Abimelech died, why did you go so near the wall? Well, what was the historical reference there that this speculation of Joab that David might retort to the messenger, where did this come from? Well, to refresh our memory on that, Abimelech was the son of Gideon, and Gideon had another name. He was known as Jerubbaal, and Jerubbaal was also Jerubbaal. Besheth means shame, and that was sometimes substituted for Baal in names. And so, and why was Gideon called Jerubbaal? Because he had torn down his father's idol to Baal. And so then Gideon dies. He has a son named Abimelech. Abimelech takes over the kingdom. He was a jerk. And he was chasing, I forgot who he was chasing. But in Judges 9, he's chasing somebody. He comes up north at a place called Thebez up there in Upper Ephraim, maybe in Manasseh, I forgot where. We read in Judges 9, 52 through 53, so Abimelech came to the tower and fought against it and approached the entrance of the tower to burn it with fire. But a certain woman threw an upper millstone on Abimelech's head, crushing his skull. So this is sort of a great story. People remember that kind of thing. And so Abimelech got killed because it came too close to the city wall. So that would be a good example for David to hypothetically rant and rave against Joab. Why did you get so close to the wall? Don't you remember what happened to Abimelech when that woman killed him with a millstone because he was too close to the wall? But at any rate, Joab tells the messenger, hey, here's your ace in the hole. This will calm him down. Your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. Now, as we're going to see later, David didn't get mad at all. So all this is hypothetical on Joab's part, thinking maybe David will be mad. But David didn't get mad at all. Now, there's one little problem for my theory that Joab is trying to get back at David by trying to use Uriah's death as a means of appeasing David's anger, which would then, of course, make David look guilty of the death because he's happy at Uriah's death. The problem with that is that David might not get angry, and so there would be no opportunity to bring up Uriah's death as a means of appeasing David's anger. I mean, David might not get angry after all. Why would Joab expect that David would be angry with Joab at all? Joab did exactly what David asked him to do, and as a matter of fact, as it turns out, David didn't get angry at all. Well, maybe Joab suspected that David would feign anger. He would pretend that he was angry. Oh, that's terrible. Joab lost the battle. What an idiot my general Joab is. Now, David might have done that to make it look like in front of the messenger that he was upset that Uriah was killed to cover up his guilt in killing Uriah. And he wanted the messenger to see him. David wanted the messenger to see that he was angry. So he fakes anger, so that would make the messenger to think, well, he must be really sad that Uriah got killed, so he couldn't be guilty of killing him. So Joab might have anticipated that David would do that, and in doing that and getting angry, that would make Joab look very bad in the eyes of that messenger. And so he says, well, you just tell him that Uriah's dead, and that'll stop him from getting angry. The reason I think that Uriah might have suspected that David would show fake anger because he would know that if David sat there and listened to the messenger and didn't show any anger at all, there'd be something funny about that. It would make David look happy over the death of Uriah. It would make him seem indifferent about the loss of the battle, and that would make him look guilty. So Saul tells the messenger, you tell David that Uriah's dead, and if he's angry, like I think he might be pretending to be, that'll calm him down. Now, of course, calming David down in front of the messenger is going to make David look guilty. Well, all of that is a bunch of highfalutin speculation brought to my mind by Adam Clark, and I added some more of my speculation to it. Who knows? Maybe Joab told the messenger to tell David the military defeat, what happened, and incidentally, we had some casualties, including Uriah the Hittite. Now, that casualty would sound incidental to the messenger, but it wouldn't be incidental to David, and I suspect that might be the easiest solution to this, is that Joab just mentioned it in passing, knowing that it would be very important for David to know. But it could be Joab was more nefarious. That's why I like to go into all the speculation about how he's trying to make David look bad in front of that messenger. And remember, other people know about Bathsheba going into David's apartment. All those servants, the servants know everything. I'm sure you saw Downton Abbey. They know more about what's going on than the nobility upstairs. We go now to 2 Samuel chapter 11, verses 22 through 25. So the messenger departed and came and reported to David all that Joab had sent him to tell. The messenger said to David, "The men prevailed against us and came out against us in the field." That would be the Ammonites in Rabbah. "But we pressed them as far as the entrance of the gate. Moreover, the archers shot at your servants from the wall. So some of the king's servants are dead, and your servant Uriah the Hittite is also dead." Then David said to the messenger, "Thus you shall say to Joab, 'Do not let this thing displease you, for the sword devours one as well as another. Make your battle against the city stronger and overthrow it,' and so encourage him." So you see, David didn't get angry at all. The messenger didn't wait till David got angry in order to tell David about Uriah's death. He just went ahead and told him. John Gill says, "Because of this, perhaps the messenger had some suspicion from the manner of Joab's telling him what he should say that this would be acceptable to the king." Well, Gill sort of backs up my theory that I just told you, that Joab deliberately planted suspicion in the messenger's mind. Well, in any event, all of that is very interesting speculation, but David subjects himself to some suspicion. He says, "Well, you know, these things happen. The sword devours one as well as another. Common people get killed, nobles get killed, Uriah got killed. Tut, tut. Go back and keep fighting. Encourage Joab. Don't let him feel bad about this military defeat." And so David didn't react like you would expect a king to react. Grief, anger about the lost battle. He just said, no big deal. So David's looking sort of guilty here. Now, he just said, "Well, one dies as well as another. No big deal." But contrast that when David learned of the deaths of Saul and Jonathan at the Battle of Gilboa. 2 Samuel 1, 11 through 12. "Then David took hold of his clothes and tore them, and all the men with him did the same. They mourned, wept, and fasted until the evening for those who died by the sword, for Saul, his son Jonathan, the Lord's people, and the house of Israel." Mourning, weeping, and fasting? We don't see any of that when Uriah dies. David even composed an ode for Saul and Jonathan when they died. The Song of the Bow, 2 Samuel 1, 17 through 18, David sang the following lament for Saul and his son Jonathan, and he ordered that the Judahites be taught the Song of the Bow. It is written in the book of Jasher. Well, it doesn't look good for King David just to poo-poo this thing. And whether Joab deliberately encouraged the situation so that David would look guilty or not, again, that speculation, either way, David did look bad. Adam Clark says, quote, "What abominable hypocrisy was here. He well knew that Uriah's death was no chance medley. He was by his own order thrust on the edge of the sword." We go now to 2 Samuel 11, verses 26 and 27. "Now when the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she mourned for her husband. When the time of mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife. Then she bore him a son. But the thing that David had done was evil in the sight of the Lord." Well, how had Bathsheba heard that Uriah was dead? Maybe David sent her the news. Now, there's a question whether David told Bathsheba of his plot to kill Uriah. I'd imagine he didn't tell her. That's pretty bad. "I'm going to kill your husband. We're going to fix this pregnancy." It's kind of like the modern-day American man. "Oh, you're pregnant? Well, let's go see the abortion doctor so we can murder that baby." Well, I don't know if David did that or not. We can speculate that he did or did not. She could have heard it through the grapevine. David probably published the news of Uriah's death as quickly as possible in order to hide his sin. Well, that's John Gill's idea. Of course, the next question is, well, how would that hide his sin by publishing Uriah's death? Well, I can speculate. Everybody would know that Bathsheba was free to remarry now because Uriah's dead, and so David could remarry her. You notice how quickly he did it. mourning for her husband. I think that was 7 days. Bam, and then he marries her. Oh, man, not very long. I'm not sure it's 7 days. Now, the question is, did Bathsheba mourn actually or just formally? Adam Clark says she was mourning only formally. I suspect this is true. Oh, she was going around the public shedding tears and crying, putting on a mourning habit, dressed in black, not seeing any company. Yeah, it is 7 days, according to Gill. 7 days of mourning. And then she says, okay, David, let's get married. Some people say, nah, she was really upset about Uriah being killed. I don't know. She must not have loved that man too much to shack up with somebody while he's out risking his life fighting to protect her. I'm not very high on Bathsheba, to be quite frank with you. I'm not high on David either. Well, if she was deeply grieved over Uriah's death, she certainly married David pretty quickly after that short mourning period. John Gill says they married as quickly as possible so that people would think the baby was by David and legitimate. Both David and Bathsheba probably desired this, but the problem with that is, as the NIV Study Bible says, that it didn't work to get married quickly because the baby was obviously born less than 9 months later, because it took a while for David to have sex with Bathsheba. Then he has to send messages to Joab. He says, get Uriah killed. Then Uriah's got to go out. Then he's got to get killed. Then the message has got to come back. All that's going on, that takes time. Oh, and then he spent time trying to get Uriah to go over to Bathsheba's house, and that didn't work. And so that baby was, it could be 7 months or whatever, but whatever it was, people are going to say, that's kind of a short time for that baby to be born to you, David. And, that baby looks pretty healthy to me. It doesn't look like a premature baby. As the NIV Study Bible says, people may have raised their eyebrows over David's hasty marriage to the grieving widow. Since the son was born less than 9 months later, David's attempt at a cover-up was futile. Unless David could argue the baby was born prematurely, but that would be a stretch. The baby probably looked fully formed. I don't think preemies lasted too long in that ancient culture anyway. They probably would have died. You also have the problem is, what if the baby looked like Uriah instead of David? That could have happened too. Anyway, no, David's going to write a public poem of penitence, Psalm 51, because he's not going to get away with this. Now, it says in verse 27, that what David did was evil in the sight of the Lord. Well, that should be obvious, but oh no. Some rabbis and some Christians try to make David completely innocent in the affair. Well, he wasn't innocent. The scripture plainly says that what he did was evil in the sight of the Lord. And notice this is an example of how the scriptures do not whitewash the sins of its heroes. There is no such thing as an unsullied hero in the Old Testament. There is no such thing as a perfect person in this world except Jesus Christ. And David was not only was he not perfect, he wasn't even basically moral here. And yet, despite that obvious fact, and despite the fact that the scripture says here that what David did was evil in the sight of the Lord, it's amazing that there are still some rabbis and some Christians who try to make David completely innocent in the affair. Here's what John Gill says, quote, the Jews endeavor to excuse David from the sin of murder, by making Uriah guilty of rebellion and treason, and from the sin of adultery, by affirming that it was the constant custom for men when they went out to war to give their wives a bill of divorce, so that from the time of giving the bill they were not their wives, and such as lay with them were not guilty of adultery. But for this there is no foundation. Well, of course there's no foundation. Oh, I'm going to divorce you, honey, while I go out and fight, so you can have sex with whoever you want in case I don't come back. And, of course, I can have sex with whatever pretty little honey I find over there in the battlefield. Well, that's crazy. No. David was guilty. Bathsheba was guilty. There's no whitewashing this. This was a pathetic case of sin. Now, here's some other poor attempted justifications for the sin. Adam Clark said, Bathsheba started it by stripping in public. Well, no. I don't think we're going to take any blame off of David by saying, well, that's what did they call that, blaming the victim? Well, let me defend Bathsheba a little bit. She was probably minding her own business when taking the bath. It was a hot day or the end of a hot day. She probably had the window open to let breezes in. Why would she suspect somebody on the roof of the palace would be a peeping Tom, especially the king of Israel? The palace roof was higher, probably giving a good view downward, but not necessarily upward. She's focused on what's inside the bathroom and her tub, and she probably didn't look up through the window. And remember, when she was called to the king, she had no legal status to resist. Now, she could have and should have, in my view, resisted David at some point. And if she had done that, that probably would have been the end of the matter. David would have complied with her wishes, because David, like most men, are not rapists. If you say no, they won't go any further. But unfortunately, a lot of women like to feel loved. They have all these motives and emotions, which I don't understand, but which I understand are there. And they will go ahead, and they will have sex with men they should not be having sex with. Well, To blame it all on Bathsheba because she was stripping in public, no. I think Clark is totally dead wrong about that. And we got to remember, she was the victim. It's ultimately the man's fault. He had the power. He shouldn't have done it. Bathsheba was guilty too, but I don't think she was guilty of being an exhibitionist. She was guilty of adultery. She was guilty of not resisting hard enough, despite the fact that she was in a bad situation. Well, with those opinions of mine, we are now finished with 2 Samuel chapter 11, the horrible story of David and Bathsheba. And we're going to see the consequences in the next chapter, chapter 12, verses 1 through 31. Nathan rebukes David. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.